With 50,000 accountancy firms in the UK, how does the sector effectively recognise red flags and suspicious activity pertaining to money laundering threats? The UK Financial Intelligence Unit has a national remit to analyse information on economic crime received through suspicious activity reports. This is the Financial Intelligence Podcast, brought to you by the UKFIU. In this episode, we'll be delving into the accountancy sector and discussing key money laundering threats, the importance of submitting suspicious activity reports, or SARs, and the guidance available within the sector to do so.
Hello and welcome to the UK Financial Intelligence Unit podcast. My name is Emma Jane Turner and I'm a manager in the UKFIU. Today's podcast focuses on the accountancy sector, and our panellists are joining us from three different public body supervisors in the accountancy sector. We have Tim Pinkney, Head of Practice Standards at the Institute of Financial Accountants, Michelle Giddings, Head of AML and Operations at the Institute of Chartered Accountants in England and Wales, and Jodie Newman, Head of Compliance and Professional Standards at the Institute of Accountants and Bookkeepers. So, to start us off, I'm going to ask each of our panellists to give us a little bit of an overview of the work that you and your organisations do and the type and number of firms and practitioners you supervise. So, first of all, Tim, do you want to introduce yourself?
Thanks, Emma Jane, and thank you for inviting us to take part in this podcast. At the Institute of Financial Accountants, we similarly with other professional body supervisors adopt a risk-based approach. Our firms, approximately 2,000 firms we supervise. Of those, approximately 83% are sole practitioners with only one or two staff. So the emphasis is more on the smaller practitioner. We tailor our guidance and support to that market area. We have a team of reviewers that conduct reviews. It's a combination of on-site and desktop reviews, majority being desktop reviews, and fulfill our role as a supervisor accordingly with appropriate enforcement action and guidance and support.
Thanks for that, Tim. And Michelle, over to you.
Thanks, Emma Jane. So I'm Michelle Giddings, Head of AML and Operations at ICAW, as Emma Jane mentioned before. ICAW is the largest of the professional body supervisors, and we have just under 11,000 firms within our supervisory remit. They're quite a broad range of firms. So we supervise the big four, the big household names, Deloitte and PwC, but we go all the way down to sole practitioners as well. And similarly to the IFA, quite a big proportion of our firms are in that sole practitioner population. Our firms offer a range of services. So as well as doing some of audit and insolvency, they'll also do accountancy and bookkeeping. So the broad range of accountancy services that are available. You'll probably hear this repeatedly from PBSs, but similarly to the IFA, our supervisory approach is very much the same. So risk-based approach, going out and visiting our firms. We actually have a cyclical approach for our visits. We visit our firms at least once every 8 years. But for our higher risk firms, that's a much shorter period of time, more like 2 years. But yeah, mixture of desk-based and on-site reviews. And then once we take the findings from those reviews, we go all the way through to enforcement action as well.
And last but not least, over to you, Jodie.
Thanks, Emma Jane. Yes, my name's Jodie Newman. I'm from the Institute of Accountants and Bookkeepers, heading up the professional standards and compliance team there. Another of the accountancy sector professional bodies. We offer guidance and support to our members who are largely focused on the bookkeeping side of the accountancy sector, but also do branch out into other services offered, accountancy practices, payroll and the like. We supervise around 750 practices. Many of them, similar to the IFA, are sole practitioners, but some do have employees and other staff members within there. We, like all PBSs, go out and do supervisory visits, be that on-site or virtual, and desk-based reviews. And that brings us to a position where we can understand what our members struggle with, where they need guidance, or where they are performing particularly well. And we can adapt our specific guidance to support our members to help them to be compliant and understand what their obligation under the regulations are.
Great. Thanks, everyone, for that. So we know that the accountancy sector encompasses a wide range of organisations and services, from large firms, as you've said, to sole practitioners, as we've also just talked about. And therefore, there are also a wide range of money laundering threats and red flags that those in the accountancy sector may come across in their day-to-day work. What would you say are the key money laundering threats in your specific areas of the accountancy sector? And what red flags should firms and practitioners be looking out for? Jody, we'll come to you first.
I think when we're looking at risk in that area, you have to start with the idea of bookkeeping work having no risk attached to it, or that the bookkeeping work is insignificant in that area of risk. Often some our practices look at the work that they do with other accountancy practices and consider that they will pass the burden of risk and reporting, spotting risks that they could report onto the other practices that will come further down the line, or that work is going to HMRC after them. And it's really quite often the opposite, in fact, that bookkeepers are involved in the granular work with their clients. They see them much more frequently than an accountant who will just do annual returns, and they will be in the prime position to see those red flags that can crop up. So for me, a lot of the risk comes around where you consider the risk will be picked up by others in the process further down the line, and you lack the appreciation that your work as a regulated individual gives that veneer of respectability coming from you as a practice.
Great. Thanks for that insight, Jody. Really interesting. Tim, how about you?
Thanks, Imogen. Yes, I would concur with Jody in that some of the smaller practitioners are often so alone in the world that they deal with that they don't see the risks in the way that we see them, and it's important to educate them in that way. We obviously educate on issues such as, you know, cash businesses and local businesses that they deal with and obvious risks there, as well as larger risks coming from complex corporate structures. We also try and educate firms to say, you know, take a step back and look, and why has this client approached us, especially if it's something out of the norm, not from their local communities or from the normal client base that they receive. So these are areas that we try and pick up on and try and make sure that firms are aware of. Also, you know, the point of, and I know we may well discuss this later, about sort of almost de-risking, about, you know, if they think that a client's too high a risk, they might not take it on board, which is possibly correct for them to do it, rather than think about the mitigation that they can take. It's sometimes the easier stage is to actually just refuse to take a client on, rather than incorporate those risks and mitigate and understand the business models.
Great. Thanks for that, Tim. And Michelle, finally, what would you like to add to this conversation?
I wanted to make everybody aware of the ASG risk outlook that's available for all firms. So to explain, one of many acronyms in the AML world, the AASG is the Accountancy AML Supervisors Group. And the three of us are members of that group, along with the other 10 professional body supervisors. And we work together on guidance for firms to try and present a consistent and picture for our firms of what, in particular in this area, risk will look like. It's available on all of our websites. So, you know, each firm can go to their professional body and find that document there for them to read. But it goes through the five topic areas within the money laundering regulations that they need to think about in the context of risk. And everything that Tim and Jody have mentioned there are included in that ASG risk outlook. So it's definitely worth the read. Picking a specific out of that, I think the point around asking yourself the question, why has this client come to me? The sector's pretty massive. There's 50,000 accountancy firms in the UK. And sometimes we see cases where a client has gone to a firm And it's really unusual why that client relationship has been built up. So it might be a client in the north and the firm's in the south or vice versa. And in those scenarios, I think firms have to really challenge themselves and say, out of the 50,000 accountancy firms, why did that client come to me and why did they not go to somebody else? And there might be a really valid reason for that, but sometimes that geographical distance or the client might be looking to break up their service provision across a range of professional advisors, those can be red flags. And it's important to note that because quite often as an accountant, you're trying to grow your business, you're trying to be commercial, say, yes, I've won a new client, but you have to really think about the AMR risk that can be associated to that as well.
Great. Thanks for that, Michelle, and for pointing out that the importance of that document and where you can get hold of it. So once we've identified the risks, obviously sometimes the next step is to make a SAR. So moving on to talking a bit more about suspicious activity reports. The UK FIU's annual report for 21-22 reported that there were 5,863 SARs submitted by accountants and tax advisors in that year. So obviously, while this is a small percentage of the over 900,000 SARs received by the UK FIU in that year, it was a 25% increase on the previous year for these reporters. Do you have a view on whether this is a reasonable number of SARs for the accountancy sector? And if not, why do you think that is? Michelle, we'll come to you first.
Thanks. So yeah, I think it's really tricky to say what is the right number because it's hard to prove what's missing. But I do think it's an interesting statistic to look at the number of firms who haven't submitted any at all. And that's actually quite a large proportion of the overall number of firms there are out there. In terms of reasonable, the word that you mentioned in your question, I think it's probably reasonable that more firms would have submitted at least one SAR in the last 1 or 2 year period. But that's not to say that I think there should be 50,000 SARs being submitted, which is how many firms there are. But I think it's evident, therefore, when you've got that gap of how many firms aren't submitting any, that there is some underreporting going on. To deal with that, I think guidance becomes key. We really have to help firms understand what suspicion looks like, and therefore providing them with typologies of how money laundering happens and how they might come across it is really, really vitally important because they can only report suspicion when they know what that suspicion looks like. And the risk alerts, the AESG rights really feed into that. We're trying to give firms more and more information about what's suspicious so that they can spot that in their own day-to-day work and then convert that into the internal SAR, which they then convert into the external SAR.
Absolutely. I completely agree. Guidance is really important. And we'll talk a bit a little bit later about some of the guidance available from the UK FIU as well. But before then, Jodie, if I can come to you.
Yeah, I agree completely with Michelle. It is impossible to have a specific number on what is correct. But I think it's, as you say, appropriate to think when looking at the amount of clients that are being serviced by all of those firms against the amount of SARs that are submitted by the sector, it is reasonable to suggest that there probably should be more on balance. And we're also aware of the barriers to reporting around the lack of our practices, or not just our, but in general practices, risk awareness, misconceptions of the process, etc., that they don't really have the right environment at the moment, perhaps, to submit those reports when they could. So that also suggests that there could be missed opportunities to support, and the number should be higher.
And finally, Tim, what are your thoughts on this?
I would completely agree with Michelle and Jodie. However, I think questioning the number of submitted SARs by the accountancy sector against the national submission may not always reflect a true picture and really can't be assessed singularly. The worth of those SARs, their relevance, accuracy, and actionable detail need to be assessed against the numbers submitted in order to reflect the sector's understanding of the SAR submission process, but more importantly, the sector's understanding of the type and detail required for a submission. The number may indicate the sector's robust approach to SAR submissions, however, it may also identify a distinct lack of understanding of the SAR submission process, depending on how you want to read the figures. I would also say that I think in the past we might have said that we would expect the number of SARs submitted to be quite low, as there are strict controls over the handling of clients' monies, for example, by professional bodies, and most criminals are the experts in disguising the proceeds of crime. However, our work shows that there are reasonable suspicions that go unreported, and as supervisors we must consider the firm's role in allowing that to happen. While we cannot compare the number of SARs submitted by accountants with those submitted by lawyers, we would probably conclude that the number submitted should be slightly higher.
Great, thanks for that, Tim. So I think all three of you have, in a way, mentioned missed opportunities for reporting. So to give a specific example, say an accountancy firm or a bookkeeping firm turns away a prospective client due to AML or KYC concerns. Michelle, could I ask you, what would your guidance be to a firm in that situation?
So I'm going to do something that I very rarely do and refer back to the regs, because, you know, it's quite dry material. But, you know, so POCA itself talks about the fact that if you have any suspicion that comes to you in the course of a regulated business, then you should report that. I think sometimes firms think because they haven't taken the client on yet and it's not their client that they don't have to make that report. But I don't think that's true from my reading of POCA. I think as soon as you're handed that information or you have a realization of a certain level of risk or a certain level of suspicious activity, you need to make that report to the UKFIU in the normal way. There's also other triggers. So I think incomplete CDD information, or where you think somebody is lying about their identity or there's falsified documents, those are all scenarios where you should also be making a SAR. And there's that's included in the regulations themselves as well, in addition to needing to do enhanced due diligence. If you think that somebody has provided falsified documents, there's also that requirement to make the SAR.
Great. Thanks for that, Michelle. Really good guidance there. Really helpful. I suppose as a follow-on from this, we at the UKFIU often get asked about that perceived tension between client confidentiality and the obligation to submit a SAR. Jodie, can I ask you what your guidance to firms would be on this issue?
Yeah, sure. It's a really important word that you used in that, Emma Jane, in that it's an obligation. It's a legal obligation to report the SAR, and it overrides that client confidentiality question. So there are obviously other things that a practice might want to do in terms of reporting to the police, reporting to other agencies, and conducting additional reporting that aren't obligations. But SAR reporting is an obligation, and it's fairly clear cut, or it is very clear cut in the fact that it is the obligation.
Thanks, Jodie. That's really clear. And I suppose then picking up from that, we've talked about the obligation to SAR. And us at the UKFIU, and particularly in the reporter engagement team, we're focused on working with reporters, regulators, and supervisors like yourselves to improve the quality of the SARs that are submitted across all sectors. Good quality SARs provide an incredibly valuable source of intelligence that law enforcement can exploit in the fight against serious and organised crime. And I don't think any of us would disagree with that. So in your role as AML supervisors, what do you see as the biggest challenges for the firms and practitioners you supervise when it comes to AML compliance and suspicious activity reporting? I think, Tim, we'll come to you first.
Thanks. At the end of the day, I think firms, basically the smaller practitioners, at the end of the day, they're commercial organisations. So compliance requirements and enforcement activities are not always enough to engage them. They need to understand why meaningful risk assessments and reporting of suspicion is the right thing to do. The importance of AML training should not be underestimated here. We feel reporting must be as easy and intuitive as possible. In many firms, reporting will be so infrequent that it always will be a challenge, as it's not repeat work that they're doing day in, day out. The development of the new SARs reporting portal is an opportunity to re-engage firms. Engagement with the NCA in previous years often referenced DAML requests or consent orders in previous years. However, due to the nature of work conducted by the majority of firms in the accountancy sector, i.e. not transaction-based, this can have an adverse effect on firms misunderstanding the requirements, who often misinterpret a DAML request as a request to continue to act for that client. And this is something that we often see. And I think the new portal is, as I say, is a real way to re-engage.
Great. Thanks for that, Tim. I completely agree. And we will be nearer the end of this podcast, I'll cover off some of the UKFIU engagement opportunities as well. But before we do, Jody, can I come to you with your thoughts on this question?
Yes, I think there's three main risks or areas, challenges that we see within our practices in the sector in general. And the first is the fundamental recognition of when to report, identifying that risk. And if a practice isn't risk aware, they're not going to be able to see the risk in the first place. They won't have the initial engagement to consider that a SAR is appropriate. So risk awareness is really important. And as Michelle highlighted earlier on, there's a lot of guidance that all the PBSs provide to their members. The second element is a misconception amongst some practitioners around what the SAR process is. I think some practices worry that they will be directly identified by their clients as the person who has initiated an investigation through reporting that SAR. And that's fundamentally not the case. And UKFIU put a lot of guidance out to explain why that's not going to happen. Their client isn't going to have their front door kicked down the next day after they've hit the send button on a SAR, but it will be taken into account and developed as intelligence. Or at the other end of the scale, there's sometimes frustration that SARs are perceived as to disappear into some kind of black hole where they submit information and nothing ever happens. And these SARs are part of an intelligence gathering picture. So I think there's a general sort of misunderstanding and misconception around that. The third aspect is the SAR quality. I think reporters have really got to understand that they're telling a story to someone who doesn't know the background. A third party with no knowledge isn't going to be able to pick up a report and make sense of it if you don't include a lot of information about the who, why, where, what, and when. And that information's got to be really clear, specific for people who are reading high volumes. So there, I think that the three main challenges that we face around SARs and SAR compliance.
Thanks for that, Jody. And I'll pick up on a couple of points you made there about quality in a minute. But before I do, if I can come to you, Michelle, and get your thoughts on this one.
Yeah, the professional body supervisors, you know, understand and take on their responsibility for ensuring that their firms are submitting good quality SARs. And we're very lucky right now that we have the imminent launch to the general population for the SAR portal. It gives us a really good launch pad to start generating more engagement from, creates that hook for us to start sending messages out to firms again about SARs quality and what good quality SAR reporting should look like. In particular, things like the glossary codes within the SAR portal, the way that, you know, I think in the past there is kind of criticism of the accountancy sector that maybe we don't use glossary codes as much as we should do, but the new portal will allow that to happen much more readily, much more easily. They're just there available for you to pick off. And I think it's time for us to take that mantle and deliver those messages out to our firms to make sure they understand what good quality SAR looks like.
Thanks for that, Michelle. So before I ask our panelists what their kind of final key messages are for supervised firms and practitioners, I just want to pick up on this question of SARs quality and ensure that all of our listeners know about the engagement opportunities with the UKFIU. So as I said earlier, I'm the manager of the reporter engagement team, and our team is happy to liaise with any of the reporting sectors and any of the supervised firms and practitioners from within them and help you to improve the quality of your SARs. We provide a lot of guidance on the NCA website, but we can also provide one-to-one feedback and guidance as well. So please do get in touch with us at ukfiuengagement@nca.gov.uk. And also our website includes a lot of information about that new SAR portal that we've been talking about. Hopefully, a lot of you have already had a look, but if not, please do have a look at the NCA website. So hopefully that's given our panelists a bit of time to think about what their final key messages would be. So Jodie, I'll come to you first. What is your final key message to share with your supervised firms and practitioners? What further support and guidance can your organisations offer to help them with their suspicious activity reporting?
I'd say that the key to it for us is to keep it simple. Once you've got that real risk understanding and you do understand what you're looking at and you can identify a risk properly, not to get too wound up in the worries of whether you should or shouldn't submit a SAR. There's sometimes a little bit of hesitation as to whether the threshold's been hit, and that worry, as I spoke about before, as to what the repercussions are. Realistically, if you're worrying about it and you're erring here or there, should I report or not, it's very likely you do have the required level of suspicion to report. So we would say report it, because it's better to err on the side of caution rather than not submit.
Great. Thanks, Jodie. And Tim, what key messages would you have for your supervised population?
First of all, I would agree with Jodie, err on the side of caution, submit that report if there's anything that you feel uncomfortable. Also, I would say from my point of view, when I discuss this with my reviewer team, we already know generally within 10 or 15 minutes of a review whether a firm is going to be compliant or non-compliant, because we can sort of witness firsthand that compliance culture. So my key message would be develop a compliance culture within your firm which encourages professional skepticism rather than adopt policies and procedures as a simple tick box exercise.
That's great, Tim. I like that. Develop a compliance culture. Really great. And Michelle, last but not least, your thoughts.
Well, my key message is it's really important for accountants and bookkeepers to raise their perspective up out of the narrow corridor of the specific service that they're providing. And what I mean by that is if you're doing bookkeeping or accounts prep, don't get lost in the mechanics of posting this transaction to this ledger or another transaction to another ledger. If you're doing audit, don't get lost in the specifics of unrecorded liabilities testing. You need to be bringing that constant professional skepticism to everything that you're doing and thinking about the transactions in the context of your overall knowledge of the client. Do these transactions make sense based on that knowledge? But it's really important to say one red flag doesn't necessarily mean you should be suspicious. We normally talk about there being multiple red flags and a layering of those red flags to bring you to the point that you'll want to take a second look at something and then probably make that report.
Great. Thanks for that, Michelle. So that brings us to the end of this edition of the UK FIU podcast. I'd like to thank Tim, Michelle and Jodie for your input. Some really important things discussed here today. Obviously, we've mentioned today various guidance that's available both from the UK FIU and from each of your professional body supervisors. So please do check it out and get in touch with the UK FIU if you would like to discuss anything further. So to keep up to date with our latest podcasts, magazines, and other UK FIU guidance products, please follow the UK FIU's X, formerly Twitter, or LinkedIn pages. You can also find our full collection of podcasts on Spotify and other major streaming platforms. So thank you for listening. I have been Emma Jane Turner, and this has been the UK FIU podcast.